What a night in New Jersey, ladies and gentlemen. I cannot believe it. Sean Strickland has done it again. He has shocked the world. He has defeated the immovable object that is Khamzat Chimaev. Oh, and we might have had the fight of the year in the co-main event, as predicted by a man who's about to join me. Chuck Mendenhall and Ben Folks are here today to talk about one of the most amazing cards of the year. Let's be honest, these top two fights are absolutely insane. Chuck, before we get into the flowers for the co-main event, which you absolutely will get, all three of us lads, we were on the crack on Friday and we were saying, what would have to happen for Sean Strickland to win this fight? A lot of shit happened and we're about to get into it right now, but I mean, what an event, Chuck.
Oh, I'm not sure we could have predicted it was going to go quite like that, right? I mean, we were saying like, well, we know inevitably Strickland's going to be taken down within. I saw Ben tweet out like it took 15 seconds. He thought it would take 10. I was with him. I'm like, this is exactly how you think it's going to go. The first round plays out, I think, how most people predicted how it should go. But you get that second round, third round, especially when there was no takedown attempts. And it starts to become a bizarre world. You're like, what am I watching? You guys tell me too. Like, the strange thing that happened in that third round was you start to dupe yourself into believing that, okay, this fight is standing. This means that Strickland is fighting his fight without, and then you kind of lose track of like, wait a minute, Chimaev actually might be winning the exchanges in this fight. It was very much like the Evalev Lerone Murphy fight in that sense, where all of a sudden the optics are all skewed and you're dealing with your preconceived notions really more than you are the actual fight itself. But and then to kind of see it how it played out in the end there, and there was a very strong feeling at the end. I know that you guys probably saw the same thing. Strickland, you're like, at the very end, you're like, did he just win this fight? And it turns out he did, man. It was a very close fight. I want to hear you guys' scorecards. I had it 3-2 for Chimaev, but I was in that third round. Obviously, that's the big swing round.
And yeah,
that's the one I was like, I guess I'm going to skew it towards to Chimaev there. And I'm thinking that must have been the swing round for the judges here.
That's what I thought too. I mean, and that third round, I think it is close. That's the one where you kind of look at it and you're like, that could really go either way. And I scored it for Chimaev, but I could understand what people might be thinking if they give that one to Strickland. But I also think this is a concept that came up when I was at the Combat Sports Officials Summit in Las Vegas, where they were like, don't give sympathy rounds, meaning where one guy was doing really well and then the other guy comes back, but he's not necessarily winning, but you just start saying, hey, he's doing better. And so you give him that round. Or a guy comes out and he's doing better than you expected, either because of these preconceived notions you had going into the fight or what you saw earlier in the fight, and you give him that round. And I kind of feel like maybe that's what was happening a little bit, just because everybody who knows what they're looking at is watching that third round and thinking, if we're standing up the entire time, we're doing what Sean Strickland wants to do,
right?
We're not doing what Chimaev wants to do. And yet he was, I felt like, landing the bigger shots. Again, I felt like this is, in some ways, once it turned into a stand-up battle, it was a typical Sean Strickland fight in that you're watching him and you're going, why don't you just do a little bit more? Why don't you throw something behind that jab a little more often? You know, because it's just so much jabbing, jab, 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 back up, circle away, jab, jab, jab. And you're just like, just a little more, man, just a little bit more. Because when I was watching him, I was just like, you're doing much better against Khamzat Chimaev than anybody expected. But I don't know if you can jab your way to a world title. You know, I think you need, especially because Khamzat, he's landing some of those right hands. You know, he smashed on Strickland's nose. He seemed to be landing the more impactful blows, even when it was a striking fight. And so that, I wonder how much that played into it for the judges, is them just being like, hey, the fact that we're even standing here trading punches means that Sean Strickland is having his way, when in fact he's backing up a lot. He's the one sort of just like throwing out that jab at times, like as if he's just telling Chimaev, like, get off me, leave me alone. And it didn't really seem to be hurting Chimaev very often.
I had it the same way as Eric Collin and Sal D'Amato had it. So that is, Chimaev wins the first 10-9, Strickland wins the second and the third, Chimaev wins the fourth, and Strickland wins the fifth. I'm perfectly fine with people having Chimaev in the third. Like, I get it. It's bigger blows against volume. I think they put up a stat at one stage, and I think it was like 30 strikes to 51 or something, in Strickland's favor. But as Ben said, I think Chimaev's were a lot more impactful. It's amazing that he was even in this situation, though. And the second round was massively.
What happened in the second round? What happened to Chimaev in the second round? Because you're looking at it and you're like, because I think we all kind of had this concept of Chimaev, right? Where you're like, hey, he exerts a lot of energy with his wrestling. If he can't get you out of there early on, if he can't submit you early on, then he will start to fade. But nobody thought he's going to fade in the second round.
Right.
He's dominating.
Pulling guard. Pulling guard.
Yeah. Well, and especially like not only pulling guard, but just like that body language of I'm shooting in and I'm not necessarily shooting in on a good shot or like a well set up shot. I'm shooting in on a shot where I went, I really need this to work. Like, not that I've made it work. Like, I really hope it does. And then when it doesn't, him falling to his back is just kind of like shit. Like, I don't have a plan from here. And that was really stunning to me. I mean, he came back. He found his second win after that. But I was watching that even, and being like, what is happening with you right now?
And you could see the frenzy in the corner at the end of the second. Yeah. You're saying things to him that you're saying to a defeated fighter, a guy where you're like, I hope he gets back up off the stool now. They were saying, you're fine, mate. Like, everything's okay.
It was kind of like, don't panic was the tenor of the conversation.
Like, while everyone is screaming, you know, everyone's like, calm down in the corner. You're like, oh, shit, man, this is not good. It's crazy that it's come out like this, because the whole feeling of the event, obviously, was about this blood rivalry. Dana White saying beforehand, this is the most heated blood rivalry we've had since Habib v. Conor. And the language that was used ahead of it certainly spoke to that. Inside the ring, when the boys get there, there is uniforms everywhere. There is the head guy of the security team that is telling everybody, as these two guys are faced off, he's speaking to the security team saying, stay focused. It's this dude here with the chain. He's talking to security guards and he's telling them to stay focused as these two dudes are suddenly high-fiving each other, at the start of the fight. And this is...
That looks like the crying Michael Jordan meme telling him to stay focused.
I know. That looked like Michael Jordan, the one dude.
He was wearing the jeans and everything. But... Yeah. These guys like had such a fierce rivalry, and inside the ring, it didn't really give us that. And then at the end of the fight, we have Sean kind of, you know, hat in hand saying, listen, I hammed this up. I went too far with my language, all this kind of stuff. I mean, it's pretty unbelievable.
We talked about this, by the way. We were like, you know, remember we were talking about the props. We're like, something happened afterwards. And we're like, I don't know. And we were basically pointing out like, Sean Strickland's a different guy at the end of the fight. He's always kind of more like, ha, guys, I appreciate you bearing with me through that whole thing. And, you know, it's just a ruse.
Well,
thank you for coming out.
This is his therapy, right? Like, fighting is his therapy.
It is.
Therapy is not going to be his therapy. So fighting and sitting in the front seat of his car talking to people on Instagram, those are his forms of therapy. And so it's like, I think that he, by the end of a fight, he's kind of like worked through some stuff. He's sort of like the out of control kid who just like needs to get it out of his system, and then he can calm down and be normal a little bit. I wondered as I was watching this fight, and I started to think about, okay, these are guys who have sparred together in the gym before, and it feels like we've fallen into a sparring match at some point in the fight. Like, it just had that kind, like the rhythm and the intensity of that felt sparring-ish. I couldn't tell how much
round,
of that is
especially.
I was wondering, I was like, some of that might be that's what Sean Strickland likes to do. Like, that when things are going well for Sean Strickland, it often feels like he's just sort of sparring. And I couldn't tell if it was just because there's a familiarity there. Like, Khamzat just very friendly. We went from just like the menacing glare across the cage to start the fight as usual to just
all
like,
of a sudden,
hey, like
Pat Barry against Crow Cop. You know, they're hugging each other.
Yeah, it's just, I love you, man. We're all happy to be here. Like that kind of a thing.
Yeah.
That I thought was very strange. That was not exactly what I expected, especially as you said, where you bring out the entire security apparatus of the state of New Jersey to prevent all hell from breaking loose, and instead a sparring match breaks loose.
Did it affect you guys, I guess, that they were that friendly? Because honestly, the fight, the way it played out was dramatic enough. I mean, you didn't really need the bad blood in the end, but it was weird.
I think
weird.
It was living off the fumes of the bad blood. I think the fight was living off the fumes of the bad blood, even though we had this kind of reconciliation before the fight actually happened. Like, we had this kind of glove touch. I still think there was, it was off the fumes of that, because the fight wasn't that eventful, really.
Not really, not in the sense that the only thing that was strange about it was, I mean, there were a couple of factors, but like the big one was obviously the second round, the takedowns are stuffed. By the third round, there are no takedown attempts. And that, I mean, that's surreal when you've watched when you've watched Chimaev this amount of time. You're like, wait a minute, what is going on? And so that whole round played out in a sense of pending. Like, you're like, okay, well, what are we doing? Very much like the Evloev fight, wasn't it? It's like, you're waiting for him to get busy with Lerone Murphy and to do something, even though he's kind of winning the fight the way he's fighting. But it's like you're waiting for something else that you're used to seeing to happen. That third round was very bizarre that way. And I'm sure if Chimaev goes back and watches the tape and, you know, thinks about it, that's going to be the thing that'll bother him the most, is that third round.
You know, the thing that was very telling for me in the third and the fourth round was that Chimaev was getting what he wanted in terms of, we're standing up, we're striking, but you're backing Strickland up. He's backing up toward the fence. At times, his back would touch the fence every once in a while, but he's backing up past that warning track, that black little line that fighters often call the warning track. That's where you want him if you're Hamza. Yeah. And that was something that Sean Strickland's corner was warning him about. Like, hey, you get past that line, if he backs you up toward the fence, that's when he's going to shoot. And he wasn't shooting then. And I thought that was very telling. That told me Chimaev is still worried about his cardio. Even though he seemed to kind of get a second wind after that second round, the fact that he wasn't going for takedowns then told me he's concerned about how much he has left in the gas tank. And then he did it late in the fourth, and then he did it in the fifth. Especially, it seemed like he was doing it in the fifth because he knew, okay, fight's almost over one way or another. I don't have to worry about, you know, saving something for the swim back. I can go ahead and empty the tank now. But by then, you know, he wasn't dominating Strickland the way he was in that first round. You know, like that to me just said, like, he's worried about his own cardio. He doesn't feel like he has that ability to just go after this guy.
Right.
And, you know, honestly, probably felt like, hey, maybe I'm doing better in the stand-up game. Like, I don't need to. Like, this is going okay for me. And it's not like Sean Strickland's really hurting him with too much. But it is just like, I think that it's in people's heads, if we're standing here and we're trading punches, that we must be doing Sean Strickland's game.
And Strickland, too, has got to be just one of the hardest guys to deal with in terms of, you ever, like, you see those, like, lanky dogs, and, like, when they get joyful, like, they go in different directions, they're more muscular than you understand, they're harder to kind of, like, corral. He strikes me that way, because you'll see guys, like, it looks like they're trying to do what they would normally do, but for whatever reason, this guy is coming, like, strength in different directions. Even on those early, in the first round, in the takedowns, when he was going up against the fence, he's kind of butt scooting over there, and he's like doing this stuff. You could just tell it's like this, some kind of, like, you know, just, you know, unruly energy or something that's coming out of him, and like strength, because it just wasn't easy. And I feel like we keep seeing this with Strickland as maybe something I got to stop underestimating when I make the, you know, when you think about these fights. We know he's a hard out. I knew he could get up and say, he didn't do it in the first round, but he clearly wore down Chimaev a little bit, you know, just by just fighting off, fending off the submission attempts and everything else. But he just must be a lot to deal with. You know, like, you watch him, it's just awkward, and you see guys kind of change their mind on what they want to do midway through the fights. It's just weird, isn't it? Like, I don't recall a guy like this.
Yeah. He, you know, I have to give him credit. Like, the calmness, the composure he had in the first round was pretty incredible. You know, when that dude is all over your neck and he is just floating. Every time you think you're back up, oh, he's suddenly on my back again. Oh, I'm on the ground again. Oh, he's trying to choke me again. The stoicness of Strickland in that moment, like, attacking 2-on-1, really by the book defense every time. Like, I just need to control this choking arm. I know I'm in an awkward position. I need to just sit this out. It was incredible to see, but I just can't believe that was it. You know, I was like, well, this is going to be 3 rounds of this. You're about to get 3 rounds of this. It is an amazing thing that Strickland has done this again, as he did against Izzy. But I can't help but think, what happens to our perception of Chimaev because of this? What happens to...
He's not the machine, like the unbeatable machine that everybody thought, right? Sean Strickland showed you that if you could just make it through that first round and not get choked, which, again, just to be clear, that is all Sean Strickland did in that first round, was not get choked. He did not do a single offensive thing in that first round. He just avoided submissions. And
I'm happy for that to be a 10-9, though, Ben. Are you? Because the lack of damage. Because
there's no damage there. Yeah. I agree with that. But I also think that that same damage-heavy scoring criteria is what works against Sean Strickland in some of these other rounds. That's why I score it for Chimaev. Like, in the third, it's just because, you know, Sean Strickland is throwing out a lot of jabs. You know, he's etching out there. He's touching them. There's not a whole lot of clean shots that he's, you know, like Chimaev is blocking a lot of those. And when Chimaev is Chimaev lands a right hand here or there, and it does seem like more impactful. He seems like he's doing more damage in those moments to me. But I do think everybody before was looking at Chimaev where he's just like, he's a machine who just doesn't stop coming after you. Everybody can say, hey, if you can make it through that early going, then maybe it gets easier. But nobody had really proven it that much. Sean Strickland was able to go out there and prove it. The thing I was thinking is, if I'm Dricus du Plessis and I'm watching this one at home and I see that, I'm praying so to weird. Hear and new. You know, when they put that belt on Sean Strickland and you're just like, so you're telling me I'm back in it, right?
Like, that's true. That's a good point.
I didn't have anything for Khamzat, couldn't defend the wrestling, but we saw the way I took apart Sean Strickland, right? Like, do we want to do that again? You know, I'm thinking the UFC probably does not want to just like get in that rinse cycle and do it again. But it is interesting, especially because I think that there's probably a lot of people out there, a lot of other middleweights who are like, this is a world I would rather live in. The one where Sean Strickland is the champ I have to go out there and beat rather than Khamzat.
Petey,
when you mentioned that,
let me ask you something.
Yes, please.
Does the weight cut, like, it looked like a hard weight cut, right, for Chimaev? Does that factor into this? You were mentioning this, right? Like, he looked like death on the scale. Like,
there's a million people out there that will tell you he didn't make weight for this fight. There is a million people that will point to the scales, all this stuff. I saw DC countering those arguments. But I did see footage of Chimaev looking, and this is not completely uncommon. We need to stress that. But looking like death warmed up after that weigh-in and just like taking that beeline straight to the car. And honestly, that grappling heavy style is very reliant on an engine. And I know if you trained your whole life, there's a certain amount of muscle memory you're going to have and your body will work a certain way. But at the highest level after, like I saw clips of Armin Sarukian this week saying that Chimaev had to cut 21 kilos. That's about 50 pounds. Like that's 40 odd pounds anyway. It's
crazy.
I can't do the exact. It's between 45 and 50 pounds.
How big is Strickland then? Because didn't Strickland look bigger in there? Like he just looked.
Yeah, it didn't look like there was a huge size disparity. Yeah. And also, I got to think like, if you have to cut that much on fight week, then either you've gotten too used to huge weight cuts and you take it for granted, or you mess something up. You know, you came in too heavy and left yourself, or you're injured. That's usually the other way it works. Is that like
that's what I'm wondering if we're going
to
hear
what you needed to do.
You know,
I imagine we will.
Yeah, but I mean, I would expect. I think that like if it was really that you left your best stuff in the sauna, essentially, you know, you weight cut took it out of you, and you didn't have it. He got a second wind after that. He looked terrible in that second round, but then he came out there and he was in it the rest of the way. So
he was in it, Ben, but he wasn't Chimaev. He didn't look like the guy that we imagined.
If you look at some of his past performances, even in the Dricus fight, as dominant as he was, he faded. He got less and less dominant as a grappler as the rounds went on. You look at what he had against Kamaru Usman, you know, like even there, like against a smaller guy where you're just like, that is a known thing with him that he comes out, he starts fast, comes out hot. But if you can get through that, he will slow down a little bit. So I don't know. It's hard for me to look at that and just immediately go, you know, he had nothing left on fight night because he still had plenty left. You could very easily make a case that he won that fight, I think.
It is such a perception skewing thing now, because you're like, Sean Strickland, you know, you kind of leave him for dead. And I mean, you know, in the contender sense, right? Like, or as a champion or becoming a champion again, it's just, you leave him for dead because there wasn't the path.
His
back
coach was sounding somehow. Like he left.
I know
that his coach was saying, like, I don't know.
I know. Remember this?
You know?
I mean, yeah. It's crazy that suddenly, this quickly, we're talking, he's wearing the belt again. We're talking about him. And then the Shamayev thing, I mean, you know, he was, every time we get into this discussion about, like, should he move up to 205 pounds before he's even defended the title yet? You know, we're like, should he move up? And, you know, you talk about these things. We see this sometimes, right? And then it becomes like, okay, now what for this guy? Because the sheen of invincibility, or whatever you want to call it, that boogeyman thing that he had going on, was his biggest attribute. But once you see something where you're like, okay, wait a minute, the formula is, you know, you start to see the formula, it becomes something else, right? And so now he's got something to prove, beyond what he's done. So the perception of where he's at, what he's going to do next, is going to be a big deal. And then for Strickland, it's even harder, because to put him back into a space where you're like, okay, he's the champion, and like, what does that mean going forward? Is wild, because I think I never even imagined that we'd be here. I just never imagined that we'd get back to a Strickland era. I wasn't even sure he could get back to a title shot, just because I felt like the UFC was like, okay, we've heard enough of him on the mic. We don't want him anywhere near the belt. But here he is. It's a crazy turn of events, man.
Do you mentioned like what we're going to do with Strickland, Chuck? Is there any immediate interest in an immediate rematch here for Shamayev? Do you think, if you're the UFC, because we have Nasruddin Imovov out here saying,
"Yeah,
I'm going to put your lights out, Sean Strickland." That's what he's saying.
Oh, did you hear that? I felt like I heard the call of a mighty raven from up there on the rafters.
Oh God! It's
Imovov time. Damn it!
Imovov's like, it's his avatar time. Was a raven. You know, it's like, oh, you think it is? I mean, see, I will say this.
The context of the raven here.
I know.
For your information, Ben has said that Imovov, if he had a gimmick where he had a raven, and that flew up into the rafters while he fought, and then flew back down onto his shoulder afterwards, people would be a lot more interested.
And talk to him a little bit. They need to
have a mystical kind of connection, him and the raven. If he had that, he'd have been in this title fight. But I think
he'd have already been here.
I don't think you can turn right around and do an instant rematch, because especially you sold people Blood Feud for the Ages.
Right,
and you
right.
didn't quite get that. Everybody's very friendly, but
they
end.
High-five before.
Yeah, and you know, people aren't going to go for it again. People are going to, like, you know, they might go for it later on, you know?
Yeah.
But you can't turn right around and sell them that same thing when they just saw that it didn't deliver that. So I do think you got to do something different. And I think that, you know, what better time for Imovov to get in there and get a shot now? Because right now, it's just like you said, we didn't think we were going to be back seeing another Sean Strickland title run. And so let's do something different. You know, let's see if him and Imovov can run it back, and something different will happen in this time. The thing that I think was, to the extent that Chimaev was exposed, I think what it exposed about him was that as dominant a wrestler as he is, as dominant a grappler as he is, his ground game is a little too, I don't want to say one-dimensional, but he's just focused on submissions. You saw it in that Dricus du Plessis fight where, like, he's getting you into the good positions and he's just thinking about finding the choke. He's doing that kind of just like classic submission grappling thing where he doesn't mind being on the bottom as long as he's on your back. And he's not looking for dominant position that he can punish you from. Because especially against these guys,
do you not think he makes him struggle
the best in the world? I think you got to soften him up. You got to give him something else to worry about. All Sean Strickland had to worry about in that first round was hand fighting. Just fight the hands. Make sure that at all times you got like a two-on-one grip on at least one of his hands. Make sure he doesn't have both hands free to choke you with. And when you make it, especially for guys like who are very, you know, Sean Strickland, it might be a striking first guy, but he's a very competent grappler. You're not going to
just overwhelm
that guy. Yeah, like when all he has to think about is hand fighting and stopping you from getting that choke all the way in, it's a lot easier on him. if you give him two things to worry about, the choke and you elbowing him in the face from the top position, then it gets a lot harder. You know, like that's kind of like what you would see guys like GSP do, where it was just like he is takedowns,
yeah,
top control, and ground and pound, and then opportunistic when it comes to submissions. And Chimaev is taking you down and immediately hunting for that submission, trying to latch onto your neck. And it just makes it a lot easier for people to defend against when they know I'm only defending against that. He's not throwing a bunch of different stuff at you. He's just trying to do one thing, and you know what that one thing is.
Did you guys get a big fight feel when they got in the cage? This was one of the rare times, and it's, you know, I admit, you get jaded. You watch the sport so much. You see so many main events. Sometimes you're just completely immune to it. But this is one of those moments, man, when these guys got in there, and especially with all the security and everything, I was like, wow, this is like it used to feel. Like, I was like, this is crazy. What's going to happen in here? I guess we find out. It's time to find out. That was fun. You know, it's like, it's fun to kind of get into that situation again. You were asking about the rematch. It's only in that sense, right, that you got like sort of a big fight feel that kind of got through even the toughest, you know, sheens or whatever. Like, you get through that and you have this collective moment. People are texting me. I don't know if you guys were getting that. I was getting a lot of correspondence from people you don't usually talk to, but they're all watching this fight. That's why if they did an automatic rematch, it's just because they tapped into that. I think I'm with you, Ben. Like, I you know, Sean didn't have to go so hard to the apology well and be like, guys, I'm sorry, you know, because if he had played that a little
bit. Never tell people it was just to hype the fight.
Exactly.
Ever.
You don't want to. Yeah, exactly right.
Never. So, never.
I mean, honestly, if you're looking at, like, this was a good fight, right? Like, it had a lot of dimension to it. There was a lot to think about, probably a lot of regrets. I don't know if you could point to all of that stuff in the first Imavov Strickland fight. I know that fight was at 205 pounds. Most people don't even remember that fight existed. That's the problem, and that's why we need a Raven. You know, it's because you're just not going to remember an Imavov fight. But you can't just have him there, right, and show him on the Jumbotron and all this, and then just be like, nah, you don't factor into this at all.
Sorry, I was just getting some messages from Jordan there, boys. Were you waiting for me to say something interesting there? Because I do have something interesting to say.
Yes, I was. Okay, go ahead.
We have the bonuses, ladies and gentlemen.
Okay.
Fight of the night is Van Tyra, which we will be speaking about very shortly. Performance of the night go to Jim Miller and Yaroslav Amosov. So there you go.
Man, you're right. What a card. Jesus. There's some crazy performances tonight.
Before we get onto that, though, Ben, I gotta ask both of you guys. But, Ben, how do UFC feel about having Strickland as champion right now? Because I've been watching this fight. In the third round, I'm hearing choruses of USA, I think it was Fuck Chimaev or something to that effect that was going over. Like, this guy, he is an anti-hero. I know a lot of people do not like what this guy has to say, particularly in the build-up to fights, but it is reverberating with a big slice of the UFC core, I would say. Am I wrong?
I think there's like a weird disconnect sometimes where some of us in the media are like, oh, well, Paramount's not going to love having this guy once he starts espousing his various views about how women shouldn't vote or whatever. But the reality, I think, is that the UFC is like, we're into it. We're totally into it, man. The UFC has shown us that you kind of can't go too far in that direction for them. You know, they kicked Josh Hokit off the press conference stage this week, but that seemed to be more for being annoying than for being like too far. Like, they don't, the too far doesn't exist. They told us that with Bryce Mitchell and the Hitler stuff, man. Like, when you don't do anything about that, when you just say, hey, that's the way it is, you're telling us like, oh, no, we're not stepping in here, at least when it comes to, like, you know, right-wing views. So Sean Strickland's whole thing, I think they're just like, we're fine with it, man. We're into it. It resonates with a certain set of the fan base. The fans who don't like it, we've already worked hard to alienate those people in a million other ways. So I don't know if they're concerned about it at all. I think they probably think like, yeah, this is, I mean, if anything that they worry about with Sean Strickland being champ, and I don't think they worry too much these days when you're not selling pay-per-views. If anything, they probably just feel like he's sort of too much of a point fighter for people to get really excited about him inside the cage. Like he talks a lot about bathing in the blood of his enemies, but he does not really do that very often, and people will catch on to that eventually. But at the same time, I mean, the entire career of Chael Sonnen taught us that if you can just sell the sizzle, you right. don't have to deliver so much knockout steak at the end, you know? Like, yeah. So I think that they're very much fine with having Sean Strickland as champ, but I also don't think that they love it so much that they feel like, let's find him the easiest opponent we can next to try to keep this going.
And the wildest thing is he keeps winning the title. So it's like, even though he's not doing the thing you're saying where he's not knocking guys' eyes out, he keeps beating the guys who, you know, we thought Shamaya was going to be there for a long time. Now he's out. Izzy at the time we thought was going to kill him. I mean, both times he's a huge underdog. This is the thing that Chael could never pull off. He got close with the Silva UFC 117, but it's the other level of it is that even if he's not doing it in some big splashy way, if he's just fighting his fight, he's somehow getting it done. That's the thing that, I mean, both times he's won the championship, we're having these conversations. We're like, what just happened? How did this work? You know, like, it's just, that's the difference. He keeps winning, and people are going to latch onto that. I'm very interested to see now if he becomes, you mentioned him being an anti-hero. I want to see how much love he gets now from the community now that he's wearing the belt again.
Well, and can he do as well when he's not in an underdog role? He excels in an underdog role. That's one of the things we talked about beforehand, that he's very comfortable there. He seems to fight much better when everybody is saying, we think that you're in over your head here and you're going to get killed. And then you go into some of those fights against Dricus du Plessis where you're like, man, your style should work against Dricus du Plessis. It shouldn't work against Hamza, you know? And like, that was one where he was just sort of, especially that rematch with DDP where he was real deer in the headlights, you know? Like, that's the thing, is like, put him in some of those fights and let's see if he can win those and see if he can go out there and defend a title.
We better talk about the co-main event. And I will preface this by saying, on Friday's show, Chuck Mendenhall, the marvelous right. mind that he has under that hat there. He said that this event gave him the same kind of feels as a Robbie Lawler v. Rory McDonald, which was the co-main event to Conor McGregor v. Chad Mendes. Now, Chad Mendes and McGregor were all over the headlines that week. It was McGregor's big coming out moment. They had the big entrances, all of that stuff. But it was, in fact, Rory McDonald and his nose and Robbie Lawler's lip and this bloodlust that happened in there, like a religious experience for most people that are at it, that people talk about to this day, like as being one of the greatest fights ever. I think we had Chuck being very right, because that for me is fight of the year so far. What an unbelievable fight between Joshua Van and Tatsuro Taira. I mean, first round couldn't have gone any worse for Van, really. He gets taken down twice. He does get up twice, though, which is very important. Then a complete flip of the script in the second round. He's dropping Taira. Taira nearly looks out of there at one point. Van pours on again the third. And then suddenly, Taira arrives back in the fourth round. Like, oh, yeah, we're back in the first round now, bitch. Here we're on the ground. I'm holding you down. You're in hell again. Then Van knocks him out in the final round. Yeah. Some people have found an early stoppage. Oh my God. But lads, I think this fight was absolutely incredible. Chuck, you called it. You may as well get your flowers, sir.
Well, thank you, Pete. It did have that feeling, and part of it was just the youth, right? Like they're both, they mentioned that they're both born in the 21st century, 50 combined years. You just kind of knew that they were going to go out there and put on a show, but I didn't think it would kind of go, I didn't think it'd go like this. After Hetsuro took him down in that first round, it felt like we'd already established. Again, both of the co-main and the main had this element where you're like, okay, here we go. This is what it's going to be. And neither fight ended up being that way.
Yeah.
This one to me, man, like from a writerly standpoint, like you think about it and you're like, it was this close to being one of the biggest lessons for Van. Did you see, like, he basically goes for, he just has to land a couple more punches. What was it in the, was it the third round? He just a couple more punches, the fight is over. The referee's leaning in and he goes for the submission. He's like, I want to prove a point, that's which
right.
I appreciate.
Choke. Right, yeah.
Yeah, which I appreciate. I knew exactly what he was doing. You're like, okay, this is an awesome moment. But man, when he, in that next round, when he found himself, or was it later in that round when he's back on his, you know, he's on his back
third
again.
And fourth. Yeah.
Yeah.
Fourth round.
And you're like, back, yeah. I was like, he's going to have the biggest regrets when he goes back and watches this. But it worked out for him. And he ended up doing the thing that I guess a rising budding star does, which is get the knockout anyway. So it had everything, man. I mean, that fight kind of had everything. Both guys, what we thought they were very good at, showed that they're very good at those things. Both guys showed a lot of heart. I mean, what else do you want in a fight like that?
I mean, this is something you talked about on the crack on Friday, Chuck, about how Van had that youthful ignorance and exuberance where you don't know yet what life can beat you down with. You don't know yet what this sport will do to you. And there was some of that, I thought, that was on display for both of these guys, because for one thing, like, you know, you had Van getting dominated on the mat early on, but then you're looking at his face during those moments and you're like, he doesn't seem concerned. He seems like he would rather be doing something else right now, but he doesn't seem like he's freaking out or being like, oh shit, I'm in trouble. He just thinks like, all right, I gotta get through this part and then I'm gonna be winning. It's no problem again. And then when he did go for that choke, like, I wondered, I don't know if that was so much him trying to prove a point or if it was just sort of, you know, automatic when you feel yourself gaining that advantage, because he locked in that choke at one point. You know, he kept going for it where he's throwing on the choke and he's throwing that hand on the top of Tyra's head rather than behind his head, and like he just couldn't quite get it behind his head. And it's like, you put it on the top of his head, you make it too easy for the guy to reach down, peel it off, and set up his defense. And but then he had it under the chin, man, and going palm to palm with it, and Tyra by that point was just able to get his back to the mat and take the pressure off that way and force him to admit like, okay, you lost it, and then get into a scramble there. But it was just like he I think just felt like it's there. Your muscle memory, your body is just telling you like that's what you do when you have that opportunity to finish a guy there. And to me, it was amazing that Tyra getting beat up the way he was, not only just like getting your brain rattled, getting your equilibrium messed up, but getting your nose smashed, getting your face is swelling up at that point, to still be able to come back and do your stuff, you know,
yeah,
to
that was wild.
Composure. That's crazy to me. Like to not only not quit, you know, not do what we've seen so many other guys do where you're just covering up and waiting for the referee to save you because you've just been so battered, but to still be able to do what you do, even when, you know, you can't breathe and your face is turning into a balloon. That's crazy to me. It was just an amazing display from both those guys, especially like to have Van putting it on Tyra like he was at the end. And the thing Tyra is mad about is that you stopped him from having the chance to absorb more of that punishment. And he was heated about it.
He would still be fighting right now, Ben. He was never going to give up with that fight.
That's the thing. Like we've all seen this, right? Where it's like there's the complaints about a stoppage that are kind of performative, where you need to, like, for ego reasons, you're being like, no, come on, I'm still in it. But that rage, that bitter rage, you could tell he very much wanted to continue that fight, no matter how badly he was being beat up in that moment.
So how do you feel about it then, the stoppage? Because I see a lot of people getting upset about it.
I think it's I mean, you could have let it go a little more, especially like what he had already endured to that point. But I understand too, like the body language is not great.
Straight down, and like he goes, poof. Yeah, the way he went down.
I mean, he turned his back, away. But I mean that, you know,
he's turning away and he's like sort of like collapsing, and
he barely stopped himself and like, going face first into the canvas. Yeah, he
barely stopped himself. And the thing that people have to understand about these stoppages is it's like the referee has to make the choice based on what he's seeing right then to jump in there. And when he jumps in there, the punches stop, the damage stops, and then the guy can turn and face you and look like he's okay. But that's only happening after the stoppage. The referee is making that decision based on what he saw 2 seconds earlier. Right. And so like I can understand why you make that decision. I think you could have let it go a little more. But at the same time, I can't get mad about that stoppage.
It was a little bit like what was that Moutinho versus Sean O'Malley? Moutinho takes all that damage throughout this fight, just keeps taking damage, but doing just enough to kind of hang around. And I think the referee stops it inside of like a minute to go. And you're like, you couldn't let him live to see the scorecards, give him that one little silver lining victory there. But I had no problem with it because if you watch it and just its normal speed, the way he turns his back, like you said, PT, it looked like he just kind of throws his hand up, prevents him from going face first in the mat. I mean, that's what the referee saw. So it's like, if you can understand the vantage point he was seeing it from and why he stopped it, there should be no problem with it.
my question to you, Chuck, is we had a discussion on the round table this week before this fight, and we talked about fan status, about what a win here would mean for him in terms of coming off the fight with Pantoja, where they didn't really fight for that belt to change hands. Pantoja was injured. We later find out that if the UFC just wanted to wait for a month, they probably could have done the rematch between Pantoja and Van. They decided not to. They went with Tyra. We had one of the fights of the year. No complaints here. My question to you is, after seeing that performance, after how highly you rated Tyra before this, do you now see Van as the man in that division, or is that not going to resolve itself until he fights Pantoja?
Still got to fight Pantoja, though, right? I mean, he's still got to fight. I have a ton of respect. I have no problem looking at him as a champion, but I'm just, for me to fully be like, you're the best flyweight out there, you got to beat him. And
yeah,
but if that's the fight of the year, Pantoja fights this way too, right? Like, he fights with disregard for his, you know, for protecting his belt or any of that stuff, or at least he did. I feel like you've got another candidate to just kind of do this again. I don't know how many of these wars Van can do, but that fight has that kind of potential too. I mean, that's Pantoja. Yeah. And he's sitting there. Did you see his expression as they kind of flashed to him?
He did the Obama face. He said, hey, you know, get your shit together and we can run it back if you want. And when he heard that, if you want, he went, what? If I want, what are you talking about, bro? What are you even saying right now? Like, it was so perfect, especially because it's like, he's not like jumping up and down in his seat being like, you motherfucker, I'm coming. He was just like, what is this kid saying right now?
I know, exactly.
I loved it. It was so perfect.
Gotta make it, man.
But I totally agree with you, Chuck. Like, stylistically, especially after you saw what Van and Tyra were able to do together, it just makes you think, man, we can get through without any weirdness injuring somebody between Pantoja and Van. That one looks like stylistically very similar, like it could be just an absolute banger of a fight. And made me go once again for maybe the 1,000th time, can you believe there was ever a time when the UFC was like, maybe we should get rid of flyweight?
I was thinking that.
You should just do away with this weight class. What the hell were you thinking?
I don't know, man.
It's one of the best things you have going consistently. The same way I know when I see some heavyweights on the undercard and I'm like, well, this could be absolute trash that you're serving me up. I see flyweights on the card somewhere, I'm like, here we're going to see some of the highest level technical MMA that will go criminally underappreciated. And yet again, they do it.
Man, Van's boxing is just fucking beautiful, isn't it? Like, it is so good.
It's great,
like, I can't believe he's landing so many shots in such a short gap of time. I'm like, oh my God, there's just another
everything down the middle was straight and right into boom. You could see his hair like flash. I was like, dude.
Yeah. You could see that jab stings. And when he throws that right hand, man, he is just ripping it. You know, the commentators made a good point about it. You could see it. Like, Tyra was able to find some success calf kicking that lead leg because he's fighting in that boxing stance. He's leaning forward on that leg. It's there, you know, it's there to be chopped away at. Like, if you can do it enough times to make a difference before he knocks your head off, I guess, then maybe it could work. But that is something where if I were game planning for him for like a future opponent, you'd be like, there's an opportunity at least, you know,
Pantoja, right? He is looking at that. Like, he is going, holy shit, man. This is a very durable guy, a guy who is no stranger to being in a dust-up. I don't think his hands are as quick as Van's. I probably don't think he's as sophisticated with just his hands, but he can strike, man, and he likes kicking away that lead.
And he knows he can. So that's why when Ben was saying, like, in that first round when he's kind of, you know, in the other guy's domain, and you're like, you see him sort of like, all right, play this out. We'll get back to square, and then when I do that, I'm going to beat his ass. It was almost like watching like Kobe Bryant or somebody like that, where the team's going on a little 8-0 run, and you see him like, all right, get this out of your system, then I'm going to systematically tear you apart, you know? That's what it looked like to me, and he did. And he still had to overcome more of that, too, but that kind of poise and that kind of confidence, and you put it all together, it makes for that kind of event, right? It makes for that kind of fight where it just – you're just going to get wild outcomes. I mean, I was last year, I think I voted for the Royval Van fight as fight of the year. For him to do it, another one that could be considered a fight of the year. I mean, this guy's a godsend to the UFC, isn't he?
I mean, it's just such a good time for flyweight, the youth in that division, all up towards the top of the division as well. Tyra, Pantoja, Kavanagh there as well. And you've got the likes of Horiguchi and Pantoja and all these different guys, man. It's such a fucking great division. You're dead right, Ben. Yeah. Amen, brother.
I was watching the first part of this fight and thinking, are we going to get a Japanese UFC champion here in the year 2026? It was looking like we were going to do it. I know, man. And it was just, it's heartbreaking. They keep getting, cause there's just the old school MMA fan in me wants to see a real Japanese MMA revival. Wants to see something that, the people can get excited about it. We can bring a UFC event to Saitama Super Arena and get 80,000 people in there again or whatever, you know, man, that's gotta be heartbreaking for Tyra. But at the same time, he's just like, it is one of those fights where I know that's it's got to be a bitter loss for him, but I feel like nobody really lost that one because it was just such an incredible display from both those guys, and you can't come away from that not feeling like Tyra got that dog all up in him, man. He's still young guy, still gonna have
26,
it,
you know? Yeah. At least he's 26. If he was 36 and this happened, you'd be like, that might have been his shot, man. That's
it. But that was it.
He'll be back,
especially at flyweight.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to give you guys a quick rundown of what's being said at the press conferences because Aaron Bronsetter, the fantastic man he is, does a lovely thread. Well, the old.
Yeah.
Let's hear it.
Do you want me to hit you with it?
Of the press conference thread. Yeah.
We talked in the lead up to this event on the Crack on Friday, and Ben told us that King Green, formerly Bobby Green, had lost a lot of jewelry. Up to the
$300,000 worth of jewelry is what he said.
That's a lot of Cuban links, as we said.
Yeah.
A lot of kibble and a lot of Cuban links. He made a big appeal for a bonus after his first round finish of Jeremy Stephens, who did not make weight. Don't worry, guys. Even though he didn't get a bonus, wait till you hear what Dana's going to do for him. Quoting Aaron Bronsetter now, White says that King Green will get his own custom shorts in lieu of earning a bonus. He says that King Green deserves a ton of credit for facing Stephens despite him missing weight. And when they were determining the bonus, they took into account the quality of opponent. So, how do you think?
Got a nice shining nickel King for you.
This is like, you know, when you're working at a job and they're just like, hey, we know the conditions have been tough lately. Everybody's been working really hard. Pizza party, guys. Pizza in the break room. You all get 15
some frozen
minutes,
pizzas.
Eat as much pizza as you can. Then get your ass back to work. Custom shorts. I mean, but there is a part of me that when you were setting it up, I was like, don't give this man more money to buy more jewelry. He needs to learn a lesson from this. This is not the sob story that I think, like, it's Jim Miller's out here being like, I'm buying my own health insurance and then my son has a rare form of cancer and I've been at this for, like, Jim Miller should be a multimillionaire for how long he's been in the UFC if the UFC is really like the NBA of mixed martial arts. King Green has made some poor choices. He messed up. He was financially irresponsible. You don't leave people in your house like that if you don't trust them while you go off to train. You got $300,000 worth of jewelry. If you give that man a $100,000 check because you're just like, hey, we feel really bad about all the jewelry you lost, go buy some more. We're not helping him at that point. We are enabling him at that point. I don't. So it's not
was
exactly
it Kevin Garnett.
Like,
you said was wearing the fake. Who? Which guy did you say that?
It was NBA Chad Ochocinco. Where he would say like, "Hey, people see I'm a pro athlete. They assume these are real diamond earrings. They're from Claire's. Somebody need to take King Green down to Claire's."
I was gonna say.
I'm telling you, man, I got two daughters. You think I haven't been up in the Claire's?
They always
are running some kind of deal where it's just like buy 7, get 15. They won't even let you go in there and like buy just one thing. There's always something like that. Take King Green down there, man, and just we can get this sorted out. We don't need to be doing all of this.
Well, maybe with the custom shorts, a trip to Claire's, that'd be pretty good, you know, as a package deal.
It is.
You roll up in there in Claire's on the barter system, and you're like, "Here's these custom shorts. What can you do?" You know, like.
White says that he had the main event scored even heading into the final round, and scored round 5 for Strickland. Great minds, Dana, me and D Dubs there. White says, and we will get to this because there was some contention about the scorecards on Volkov and Waldo Cortez. White says he thought that Waldo Cortez Acosta won the fight, but the matchmakers had it for Volkov. He says that the first round was particularly close. White, on the Freedom 250 press conference, said he doesn't want to see anyone get hurt as a result of two guys beefing that aren't going to fight each other, like Hogan and Topuria. We got a lot of Freedom. Let me see what else we got. He doesn't want to talk about Rousey Carano eclipsing the Freedom 250 numbers because he loves both of the women who are contesting that fight. So
did anybody ask, also, are you ever going to do Charlemagne the God's radio show ever again in your life?
Yeah, he is never doing that show again.
They would say no there.
I've seen so many clips of that. Like, there was just two clips at the start. I've seen like 18 clips, man. Those boys went ham.
He did not know what he was walking into. He was too used to sparring with the puppies on these podcasts. He was not ready for that.
Interestingly, there was some reports that we would get a McGregor announcement over this weekend. White says to the people there, there is no deal with Conor. He is still confident that McGregor is going to fight this year. More confident than
he was last.
Wait,
is he extremely confident?
The extremely is gone. We're down to confident now. All right.
It's not a great
downgraded to confident.
He had gone up from very confident last year to extremely confident. Now he's just down to confident. Lucy's holding that football, telling Charlie Brown to go kick it. I'm telling you.
It's a worrying development. Certainly a worrying development if you want to see McGregor fighting. So Dana also said that he would be promoting the Fury-Joshua fight. I believe it was in the stream with Nina Drama. He says at the press conference, White on whether he will be promoting Fury-Joshua. Let's see what happens.
What?
All right. Fair enough.
You're walking these ones back pretty quickly.
Saying another stuff. I guess you know, you get out there in the nightclub with the cigars and everything, and maybe you just you start to feel optimistic about the future, and we're making big promises, and then in the harsh light of Newark, it's like 2 o'clock in the morning or whatever there, and you're just being like, I don't know, you guys. Actually, now that I think about it. Let's just see.
Let's see what happens. You see that he arrived by helicopter onto the roof of the arena.
Do we have the video? I believe we have the video for the beautiful people in case they haven't seen it. Jordan, do you have the video of the helipad?
Look at this.
That's living, baby. Probably just whacking a cigar and a whiskey into him there before he gets down, goes to the fights. That's living, guys. Look at that.
Is it is the traffic just too bad or what?
No, just flexing, bro.
Just flexing.
I mean, I happen to know, like, you're really, that arena is really close to Newark Penn Station. The train runs right through there.
Yeah, it is.
You know?
Come on.
Yeah.
Would that make for a good Instagram post? Would it?
No.
I would definitely, if you told me,
it doesn't matter to me, okay?
Rolling up on public transit, I'd be like, yeah, let's see that. Let's see what that looks like.
One more tidbit before we go back to the fights. White says tonight was the last fight in Jim Miller's contract, and he just signed a 5-fight extension. If he fights out that extension, he will have 51 fights in the UFC.
He'd make it to, where are we at? UFC 328? I mean, 400's a ways off, fellas. I don't know about that one.
Yeah.
To me, the most insane stat I heard was that how he hadn't fought in 15 months or whatever it was because of his... was it 15 months, something like that, like just a little over a year, that because of dealing with his son's cancer, and that was the longest layoff of his career. And that was a man who had Lyme disease.
I know.
And still he was fighting 2 or 3 times a year when he had like undiagnosed Lyme disease. It was only like an extremely rare form of cancer where his son was fighting for his life. Like that, and even that could only keep him out for like a little over a year, all of which is to say, Conor McGregor, you ought to be ashamed of yourself. You can't get in this cage. We go from extremely confident down to confident. Meanwhile, Jim Miller is out here just clocking in.
Jim Miller should get that fight. He's earned it, you know?
Be cool for it.
Should get the McGregor fight.
Volkov v. Waldo Cortez Acosta. I had no problem with Volkov winning the fight. A lot of people seem to be upset with the 30-27 Chuck. Did you see this?
Well, the 30-27 I thought that Waldo won because of that, right? Because that third round, was it not definitive? for Waldo. I mean, I was watching that. I was like, okay, wait, if it's 30-27, this has to be for Waldo. But like the first two rounds, the way I scored it was for Volkov, even though the first round
was
close, but I felt like Volkov was doing more. Like he was just landing shots, kind of piecing them up a little bit. That's the only reason. But like, honestly, man, if you forgot about this fight, you'd be forgiven, right? That third round, though, okay, I have no idea how you could give that to Volkov. Did you see it that way, Ben? Like, what did you see there?
Here's my hypothesis, and I want you guys to tell me if you think I'm way off base. This is it is almost midnight here in the One True Time Zone, and so this is the kind of thing I'm going to say when my brain starts to get a little fried for being up past my bedtime, off my usual sleep schedule.
It's nearly 7 a.m. here, Ben, just for the record. It's nearly 7 a.m.
I know,
at
this, okay? I hate, no one can complain when you're around PT about this stuff. I hate it. Is Alexander Volkov the best heavyweight who also kind of sucks?
it's a big field we're talking about there, though.
I know. But he's like of the heavyweights where you're just like, you kind of suck. Like, I kind of hate having to watch you. But you're the best of those. And I think of Nelson Algren had a line in one of his like boxing short stories where a guy, like a manager, tells a guy where he's like, you're an agony fighter. You won't fight and you won't let anybody else fight. You know, you won't go in there and do anything that'll get the fans excited and make any money, and you won't let anybody else do it either. And that's kind of how Volkov feels to me sometimes, where I'm just like, you are the anti-fun out here, and it's frustrating to watch, but you're also still like good in a way. And every time
fireworks would start up a little bit, like Waldo come in there and slam a couple, he would leg kick him and be like, don't come in here, you know. That was effective enough, you know. But that was it. Yeah. That was kind of how he'd end the sequence.
That's how I was scoring those first two rounds, by the way. I was like, leg kicks will land, and I guess, you know, that'll do. That's what I was doing. Brady and Joaquin Buckley, right? Crazy, because the bookies were in fits. Like, I was out at this wrestling thing today, and all I was seeing was these messages about the line move and all this stuff.
Yeah, it's what was that about? Brady, I didn't understand that.
I just think it was the way Dana's saying it anyway, he just thinks it was that close of a line that if a big amount of money went on one of them, it was going to flip in a certain way. He thought it could flip like that. And in the end, it kind of seemed harmless because Brady absolutely destroyed Buckley. Like he became
the best value bet of the year.
Yeah.
At plus whatever he was.
I don't know if
plus
you saw, 130. I saw this being posted on Twitter where it was like videos from Joaquin Buckley's like training camp where he's like, we're just boxing. We're not wrestling or doing jiu-jitsu or anything. We're out here boxing. And you're just like, well, maybe that was a mistake. Hopefully we can get to a place now after something like this where just because we see huge line movement, it doesn't necessarily mean that there's something up because we've sort of gotten programmed because we've had a few instances where it seems like some shit is definitely going on. But I think that what it's easy to forget for people is that especially for undercard fights or fights that are not being super heavily bet on, like the handle, like the betting handle on those fights is not massive, so it probably doesn't take that much to start to move it, you know. And
the idiot was that bet big on Buckley is having a rough night,
right? And see, that's the thing, is like, we, you know, like they say in poker, don't assume intelligence. Like, we see something happening, you see people throwing a whole bunch of money on Buckley, don't assume that it's because they know something. They might just be dumb. They might be like degenerate gamblers who are ruining their lives, and we shouldn't like, you know, stain fighters' professional reputations just because someone out there is being like, hey, I'm gonna throw the mortgage down on Joaquin Buckley, because maybe people are just idiots.
30
should also be said, like, they could, it was nasty, but they could be degenerate gamblers having the time of their lives as well. Okay, that's also a possibility here, Ben. All right, they don't have to be ruining their lives.
The rush you get from losing 30 grand on Joaquin Buckley of a Saturday night, I'm sure there's nothing that can match that.
Imagine losing a big sum. You see him taking down that first time, and I'd be like, oh my god, what have I done?
Oh my god.
You're Krusty the Clown betting on the generals against the Harlem Globetrotters. You know, you're just, you did it to yourself.
We had
What happened there?
We mentioned that. Sorry, I had a bit of an explosion there. King Green, we talked about, got some of his money back for the old jewelry getting stolen. Atiba Gutierrez goes to the second round. Ozzy Diaz put him down. Ozzy didn't like the stoppage, obviously. He was having one of those moments. I'd say it was more towards the end of, you know, protesting. You know, I did get dropped there. I kind of woke up, though, when you were over me, and I got to make a meal of it now. Atiba, obviously, an absolute savage, calls for a style bender afterwards. If you know, Chuck, if I'm style bender's manager or coach, if I'm Behrman here, I'm saying absolutely fucking not. That's what I'm saying to them.
No, he shouldn't. He should not take on the guy coming up the rungs that fast. I mean, what you want to see from, I'd rather see Izzy take time off. I mean, I don't want to see him go against that guy.
Yeah.
It's a weird call out, isn't it? How many has Izzy lost in a row? Like four or five fights? I mean, that doesn't seem like a realistic option.
I know our producer Jordan was probably very excited to see the Tate brothers congratulating Atiba afterwards. I can only imagine Ben was also very excited about that. Did you see Andrew Tate shaking hands with him afterwards?
No, the Tate brothers are in there, huh? They're in there. They're welcome to come to these events, huh?
There they are, the lads. Amosov, beautiful. If you haven't seen this submission, go and find it. It's kind of like the Mighty Whizbar, as he wanted to call it. Terrible name. Yaroslav Amosov kind of took Joel Alvarez down and immediately had him in an arm triangle. It was absolutely fucking beautiful.
He was looking for that arm triangle the entire time, you know, which I respect it. I love the arm triangle for that exact reason, because it's just like you can isolate it even when the guy sees that you're going for it. You can still get it. And it's the move that you can get without really risking position, without burning out your arms or anything. Like it works great for MMA and for like no-gi jiu-jitsu and stuff. So I like it. You know, here's the thing I wanted to bring up is there was that Grant Dawson victory where then his corner, the America Top Team guys, you know, Mike Brown and Thiago Alves and everybody, and they're hugging him, and I can't remember which one of them it was where he was. You could hear him on the mic being like, "I'm so proud of you for winning that fight," and it was such like a touching moment, you know, especially because it's a gritty fight. He really had to dig deep to get that one. Here's the thing: I understand fighters who are big religious guys, and they want to get on the mic, they want to shout out their Lord and Savior, they want to do their religious stuff. Maybe you could like do that without focusing so much on kind of like, this is the one true religion and all the rest of you are going to hell and nothing can save you. Like, he didn't say hell exactly, but he was like, nothing can save you except, and it's just like, it's getting a little fire and brimstone, man. Like, it was a feel good moment up until you came out there and
were
just like,
it was all tears and everything.
There is one cross true and all God, I will and say, all the rest of you are fucking up by not worshiping him.
Let's walk it back here a little bit, because Dawson did explain his emotional speech afterwards, and it is quite an ordeal he's been through. My wife and I were expecting our first baby, and on Monday we found out we lost the baby. It's been a rough week. I can imagine the guy, and I know you didn't know that, Ben. I was just trying to get in there. I can imagine it is a time, I'd say that's more where the corner were coming from, but it's an emotional moment.
If we're pitching a religion, first of all, you can be like, I'm excited about my religion and everything without having to tell everybody else that they're headed for like a fire, but like also like, let's focus on the positives of that rather than like more like, we're at one point where it was just like, your works will not save you, and I was just like, man, how did we get here so quickly in this post-fight interview? And you could see Joe Rogan
cross thing
being okay about the fight though.
Yeah,
can we get back to talking about that?
And Jim Miller, as we said earlier, unbelievable win for him. Another big underdog win for Roman Kopylov against Marco Tullio. Pat Sabatini got a win over William. What was that? Sorry, Chuck.
The Kopylov thing. I mean, it's like he's again. You got a guy. All you got to do is land another punch or two, and then he's like, "I'm gonna tie you up." And like, I was like, "What is he doing?" This drives me nuts when guys do this, and he did it twice in this fight. I just couldn't understand what he was doing. Doesn't he want the $25,000 guaranteed, like, whatever finish bonus? I mean, then he goes to decision. He could have easily had that money. What's going on there?
It's true. It's true. I do agree with you. I was frustrating to watch, for sure. Pat Sabatini, you really enjoyed that one, Chuck. I saw a tweet you put up there.
Oh my God.
During that fight.
Yeah, I was driving. I was driving for that one, and I had it on a little phone there and watching it. Wasn't looking at the road, and that was bad. That was a bad time.
Don't do
that.
Did
you guys enjoy that? Did you like Sabatini?
Don't do that.
Sasakoyev got a win over Santos. Jose Ochoa got a win over Clayton Carpenter to open the card. Also, a lot of action going down in the UK at the co-op. Live Dubois v. Wardley was an unbelievable fight.
Like, still got to watch that. I missed it earlier.
Fucking unbelievable heavyweight fight. Dubois was down twice, once in the first. Then again, in the third, comes back and finishes Wardley in the 11th. And Wardley, his face was like a fucking butcher's block, man. It was an insane fight. Massive underdog loss on the undercard there as well. Dave Morrell, who's only previously lost to David Benavidez, lost. He was something like, I think he was like 1-18, like with that much of a favorite. And he got knocked out in the final 30 seconds of the last round by Zach Chelly. Absolutely insane. Really just fucking crazy, crazy fight. Before we move on, lads, I did want to say we had some inductions into the Hall of Fame, or we will. They were announced that there will be some inductions to the Hall of Fame. One of them is Tom Gerbasi. We spoke about him a lot on the show around the time of his death. Chuck, how good is it to see Tom being recognized by the UFC, a company he gave so much to in his position as editor for so many years, decades, really?
Yeah, you know, I really wondered if they might do something like this, but it still caught me off guard. I don't know how you guys felt about it when they flashed him up there. You're just not used to seeing him in a spotlight. He's one of those guys who did the work behind the scenes, and he did it for so long and so prolifically that you know, he just became ubiquitous, right? Like every time, I don't know how many times, man, in the past, this guy came to my rescue for different reasons. Like you just needed a number or you needed some information. He was always right there. He'd get right back to you. But he just was the guy who kind of told the UFC's history, you know, in his own way for a long, long time. And, you know, multiple books and everything else he's done. I thought it was a very good gesture for the UFC to include him there. And I think that's where he belongs, man. You know what I mean? I think he gave a lot to that company. So that's where he belongs.
Yeah, he is. Also, Chris Weidman was inducted into the modern wing that we saw today as well. That was announced on this card. So there it is, lads. Jordan, you know, this is Ariel's job usually. Am I fucking up? Am I forgetting something here? Or am I?
Super chats?
Is there super chats, Jordan? No super chats. So, lads, UFC 328.
We're missing one note. You forgot one. Dana White said that Khamzat told him he's going to move up to lightweight, or wants to move up to lightweight.
Light heavyweight.
Sorry.
Oh, wow. You know,
so that's the end of it.
I would advise against that, honestly.
Yeah.
After what we saw. I don't know about that idea.
The appetite can't be there for that now, right? Like, that can't be the move. Yeah. I don't know. Have to think about that one.
My God. Well, it's been an action-packed evening, ladies and gentlemen. UFC 328 is in the books. Thank you for joining me and my lovely friends, Ben Folks, Chuck Mendenhall. You know, if you go back to Friday's episode of The Crack, we predicted pretty much this whole thing apart from the main event. All right, we did give ways it could happen, and I suppose in a roundabout way.
Yeah, I was closest to being right.
Ben, how do you explain this again? What did we say?
Right even when we're wrong, you know?
Yes, yeah. Thank you. That is exactly it. In the spirit of Ben, folks, have a wonderful Sunday. Enjoy. Watch these fights again. They were that good. The top two, unbelievable. Fantastic night of fights at the Brew. We love you very much. See you on Monday. I've been Pete Carroll. They've been Chuck Mendenhall and Ben, folks. Lots of love. Mwah.